Today is Wednesday, July 15th, 2026, and you're listening to the World Socialist website. The ICE murders in Maine and Texas, and the lessons of Minneapolis. By Jacob Cross. On Monday morning at the corner of Poole and Hill Streets in the small city of Biddeford, Maine, John Sebastian Guerrero, a 26-year-old worker from Colombia with a valid work permit, social security number, and active asylum claim, was murdered by federal immigration agents. Neighbors heard as many as 7 gunshots ring out around 7:15 a.m. Eyewitness videos show agents pulling Guerrero out of his bullet-riddled vehicle, dropping him on the concrete, and handcuffing him as he bled from his head. His last words, according to witness Daniel Boucher, were, "I tried to stop." Guerrero's partner and his 3-year-old daughter, wearing bluey pajamas with a pink rolling backpack, according to the Portland Press's Herald account, watched from the sidewalk as he bled out and died. His body remained handcuffed on the pavement for 5 hours. The line that has now become standard issue for Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, that the victim had weaponized his vehicle, fell apart within hours. That was the story the Department of Homeland Security, or DHS, first gave Senator Angus King. The same story told about Lorenzo Salgado Araujo, murdered in Houston 6 days earlier, as he drove his co-workers to a construction site. When witnesses in video demolished that pretext, ICE retreated to the claim that Guerrero had, quote, attempted to flee the scene, and that the officers fired, fearing for public safety. This second lie is, if anything, more sinister than the first. It abandons even the pretense of a threat. It is a public declaration that federal agents may gun down anyone, anywhere, for supposedly trying to drive away, an assertion of the right to murder. The killings have provoked mass outrage. In Biddeford, hundreds of protesters flooded the streets within hours, rallying downtown and storming the local office of Senator Susan Collins. In Houston, demonstrations over Salgado's murder have continued for a week, with demonstrations across the country planned for this weekend. Reflecting concerns that the situation is extremely explosive, the Trump administration announced, through the office of Senator King, that ICE would, quote, pause non-urgent vehicle stops. However, Border Czar Tom Homan immediately issued a clarification, quote, it's not a policy change, it's a temporary pause, Homan told Fox News. I wouldn't even call this a bump in the road. This will be a short-term review, so ICE feels comfortable. End quote. The reign of terror continues, with new assurances for the comfort of the ICE agents. Just yesterday, another immigrant was killed, struck by a tractor trailer in St. Augustine, Florida, while fleeing ICE and Homeland Security investigation agents, who have not explained why they approached him. The authorities have not even released the name of the victim, describing him only as a Mexican. These murders raise critical political issues. It is now over 6 months since ICE agent Jonathan Ross shot and killed Renee Good in her car in South Minneapolis, and just under 6 months since Customs and Border Protection, or CBP, agents gunned down Alex Preddy as he sought to protect a woman being assaulted by the agents. These murders came amidst the violent federal occupation of the Twin Cities that provoked weeks of protest, culminating in demonstrations in January, involving tens of thousands in downtown Minneapolis. The call for a general strike against ICE became the central demand. Confronted with a movement of the working class demanding the expulsion of ICE and the prosecution of the killers, the Democratic Party and the trade union apparatus worked systematically to shut it down. Governor Tim Walz mobilized the National Guard and state police against protesters. The trade union bureaucrats worked to obey no-strike clauses in their contracts converting the demand for a general strike into a day of action. When the visible federal presence in Minneapolis was reduced through a deal between Waltz and the Trump administration, the Democrats and their pseudo-left apologists proclaimed victory. The World Socialist website warned against these complacent pronouncements. The paramilitary forces were being redeployed, and the drive to dictatorship was being stepped up. That warning has been completely vindicated. The agents withdrawn from Minneapolis street corners were dispersed as part of a nationwide occupation. ICE has been deployed to the nation's airports and more than 40 states, reaching towns that previously had not suffered a federal enforcement presence. Meanwhile, a $45 billion detention build-out proceeds. The military occupation of American cities continues, with more than 2,600 National Guard troops in Washington, D.C., 1,500 in Memphis, where a Guard soldier shot and killed 20-year-old Tyron Johnson this month, and more in New Orleans. The Posse Comitatus Act, which for nearly 150 years barred the military from domestic law enforcement, is a dead letter. On Tuesday, House Speaker Mike Johnson defended the Pentagon's request for an additional $350 billion on top of a record $1.1 trillion budget by declaring, "We're fighting communism on our very own shores," end quote. Meanwhile, the killers remain under Department of Justice protection. Good's killer and Preddy's killers are free and uncharged. Only this week did Minnesota prosecutors finally obtain evidence federal authorities had withheld for half a year, prompting Hennepin County Attorney Mary Moriarty, a Democrat, to thank her federal partners for helping promote public trust. The Democrats' toothless reforms of immigration enforcement were advanced to contain the popular movement and rehabilitate the deportation apparatus, not dismantle it. Before the killings, the Democrats had funded Trump's mass deportation operation without meaningful conditions. Once the protests receded, they dropped even their token reform proposals. What terrifies the Democrats is not the buildup of a police state, but the emerging mass movement from below that threatens the capitalist status quo. Now confronted with two more corpses, the Democrats are playing off of the identical script. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer declared Tuesday that the killings won't stop until we stop the impunity that Trump and Republicans want to preserve. He knows that impunity is bipartisan. It was Schumer and the Democrat leadership who engineered the cynical maneuver that cleared the way for nearly $70 billion in additional money for ICE and Border Patrol through 2029. This is the money that hired, armed, and dispatched Guerrero's killers. Maine's congressional delegation issued a joint letter appealing to the Department of Homeland Security's own Inspector General for a comprehensive, transparent, and expedited investigation. The letter does not demand the identification or arrest of the killer, does not call for a halt to ICE operations, does not even condemn the killing, which it describes euphemistically as a fatal shooting involving ICE personnel. Its stated concern is that timely and factual answers provide closure and ensure that future operations are conducted safely and lawfully. Maine's Democratic Attorney General, Aaron Fry, knows the name of Guerrero's killer, but is withholding it from the public, announcing only that the officer has been placed on leave. A particular foul role is played by Bernie Sanders, who has said nothing about either murder. His silence follows from his embrace of Trump's anti-immigrant framework. Sanders has repeated the nationalist claim that without borders, quote, you don't have a nation, and praised Trump for having done a better job than Biden in securing the border. His role, like that of the Democratic Party's entire nominal left, is to legitimize the deportation apparatus and block an independent movement of the working class against it. The determination to fight exists in Biddeford, in Houston, in Minneapolis, and throughout the country. What is required is an independent organization and program. every official channel is a mechanism for strangling the movement, while the machinery of terror is expanded and perfected for use against the entire working class. The erection of a police state goes hand in hand with the waging of wars of conquest, as in Iran, to steal oil and other resources, including new sources of cheap labor. The cost is imposed on the working class, in the form of skyrocketing prices and the destruction of healthcare, education, and jobs. State repression is the inevitable response to the mounting resistance of workers. The Socialist Equality Party and the International Workers' Alliance of Rank and File Committees, the IWARFC, call for the building of independent workplace and neighborhood committees to prepare mass action up to and including a general strike against ICE terror and dictatorship. These committees must unite workers across industries, nationalities, and immigration status, and establish direct links between the struggles in Houston, Biddeford, Minneapolis, Memphis, and throughout the country. The fight against ICE violence cannot be separated from the fight against dictatorship, and the fight against dictatorship cannot be separated from the fight against the financial oligarchy that supports it. The death squads in the streets, the drive to criminalize opposition, and the White House conspiracy against the midterm elections all arise from the same source: a society in which staggering levels of inequality and wealth concentration can no longer be reconciled with democratic forms of rule. The defense of democratic rights falls to the working class. It requires the fight for socialism and the reorganization of economic life to serve social needs, not the wealth of the oligarchs and their wars. Facing debacle in Iran, Trump threatens to attack Iranian power plants and bridges. By Andre Damon. U.S. President Donald Trump threatened Tuesday to destroy Iran's power plants and bridges as the United States reimposed its naval blockade of Iranian ports and bombed the country for a fourth day. Quote, "We're going to hit them very hard tomorrow night. We're going to hit them very hard the night after, and then next week it gets really bad for them. Because next week comes the power plants. Next week comes the bridges." Trump told Fox News, "We're going to knock out all their power plants. We're going to knock out all of their bridges unless they get to the table and negotiate." End quote. The deliberate destruction of civilian infrastructure is a war crime under international law. In April, Trump threatened to bomb Iran back to the Stone Ages. In June, he posted that the United States might be, quote, "forced to militarily complete the job," and that if that happened, the Islamic Republic of Iran will no longer exist. End quote. Trump's genocidal threats to destroy Iranian civilization and his renewed attacks are a testament to the deepening crisis of the war. Trump has achieved none of the war's objectives, from overthrowing the Iranian government to controlling the Strait of Hormuz. Underscoring the degree of the crisis, Trump backed off Tuesday from the 20% toll on the Strait of Hormuz that he had proclaimed only a day earlier. On Monday, he had declared the United States, quote, "the guardian of the Hormuz Strait," to be reimbursed at the rate of 20% on all cargo shipped through the waterway. On Tuesday, citing highly productive conversations with Middle East leadership, he announced that he would replace the 20% United States reimbursement fee with trade and investment deals that the various Gulf states will be making into the United States. End quote. The renewed blockade took effect at 4 p.m. Eastern Time, 1 hour after U.S. forces opened a new round of airstrikes across southern Iran. Ship traffic through the strait, which normally carries about 1/5 of the world's oil, has nearly stopped. The maritime data from Kepler counted 10 transits Monday, against more than 130 a day before the war. U.S. forces began Tuesday's strike at 3 p.m., the military said. Iranian officials and news agencies reported strikes on the city of Bushehr, home of Iran's only operating nuclear power plant, on the Abadan oil refinery, Mashahar, the island of Keshem and Kish, Sirik, and Bandar Abbas. over 3 nights beginning Saturday, U.S. warplanes and warships had already hit more than 300 sites, by the military's own account. Iran has declared the strait closed until further notice, and is enforcing the closure with missiles. Early Tuesday, Iranian cruise missiles struck two tankers of the Emirati State Oil Company, the Mombasa and the Al Bahia, in Omani waters, killing an Indian crew member and wounding 8 others, according to the UAE's defense ministry. Iran struck back across the Gulf on Tuesday, firing missiles and drones at bases housing U.S. forces. Kuwait's army said it intercepted a ballistic missile, 5 cruise missiles, and 33 drones, and that 4 of its own sailors were wounded. Jordan said it shot down 4 missiles. Sirens sounded across Bahrain. The bombing continued into the night. Iranian state media reported new American strikes late Tuesday along the southern coast and said a U.S. projectile killed 3 civilians in a town in Hormozgan province. Tehran has ruled out talks under fire. Quote, "If the U.S. thinks its military attacks and blockade will force us to request negotiations, it's making a mistake," Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister Kazem Gharib-Abadi told Iranian state media Tuesday. Iran's parliament, meeting Monday night in the first open session in more than 4 months, took up a bill to require Iranian permits and fees for every ship in the strait, with American and Israeli ships barred outright, under a draft reported by Al Jazeera. On Tuesday, about 180 lawmakers declared the deal with Washington void. "There is no longer any memorandum of understanding," said Ebrahim Rezai, spokesman of the parliament's National Security Committee. The Trump administration claims that it can wage war again because it had a pause. The White House maintains that the June ceasefire ended the earlier hostilities and that its July 10 letter to Congress restarted the 60-day clock of the War Powers Resolution. The response in major pro-war publications demonstrates the degree of the crisis gripping the Trump administration. Quote, "The Trump administration wasn't bargaining for an open-ended conflict when it rolled the dice in late February and joined Israel's military campaign to eliminate Iran's leadership and cripple its arsenal of ballistic missiles and launchers." The Wall Street Journal national security correspondent Michael Gordon wrote Tuesday in an analysis titled "The Battle for Hormuz." "This is going to be a long-term effort," Joseph Votel, the retired Army general who commanded U.S. forces in the Middle East from 2016 to 2019, told the Journal. In the Washington Post, columnist David Ignatius raised the prospect of war lasting years, citing an American negotiator's forecast that peace, quote, "will come in 2 weeks, or 2 months, or 2 years." Quote, "In retrospective, this was clearly a war based on fatally flawed assumptions," John Hanna, a former national security advisor to Vice President Dick Cheney, and now a senior fellow at the Jewish Institute for National Security of America, said in a New York Times analysis published Tuesday. "None more damaging than the president's apparent conviction that Iran's revolutionary regime was a flimsy house of cards ready to collapse in a hail of American airstrikes and bellicose Truth Social posts." End quote. The Financial Times editorial board wrote Tuesday, "The quagmire underlines once again the foolishness of the war launched by Trump against the advice of many of his allies and without much understanding of his enemy. A crisis of Trump's own making has left Tehran with newfound leverage in the strait, which Iran had never before closed in the past." End quote. In a Reuters Ipsos poll completed Sunday, 79% of Americans said they expect U.S. involvement in Iran to, quote, "go on for an extended period of time." Only 37% approved of the renewed strikes. Establishing U.S. control over the Strait of Hormuz would require a massive escalation. Holding the strait would take a ground war. Military analysts told the Associated Press Tuesday, quote, "It's very difficult to envision any scenarios where you could satisfactorily secure the Strait of Hormuz absent ground forces." end quote, said Jason Campbell of the Middle East Institute, a former Pentagon official, an operation, he said, that would require tens of thousands of troops, months of preparation, and, quote, very high cost. The forces such an operation would draw on are in place. The Abraham Lincoln and George H.W. Bush carrier groups, the assault ships Tripoli and Boxer, with thousands of Marines aboard, and more than 20 warships in all, are on station, with more than 50,000 U.S. troops in the Middle East. By the military's own account, its largest force in the region since the 2003 invasion of Iraq. Unifor Springs sellout tentative agreement on Ford Canada workers over 2 months ahead of contract expiration, by Carl Bronski. Unifor President Lana Payne announced late Saturday evening that the union had reached a tentative agreement for a new 3-year contract with Ford Canada more than 2 months before the union's current contract expire with Ford and with two other Detroit 3 automakers, GM and Stellantis. The sudden announcement included no information about the contents of the agreement, apart from its 3-year duration, and none has been divulged in the 3 days since. The Unifor bureaucracy even abandoned its standard practice of holding a post-agreement press conference. Ratification meetings are now being convened for the July 17th to 19th weekend. The union apparatus intends to corral Ford workers into the ballot booths to vote yes to the tentative agreement, literally minutes after giving them an entirely self-serving and deceptive highlights summary of its terms. Workers should be under no illusion. If the union apparatus feels compelled to use such flagrantly anti-democratic methods, it is because it is attempting to ram through a massive sellout. Payne herself has conceded the negotiations are taking place under unprecedented conditions of crisis in the auto industry. Yet workers are being told they must make a snap vote without being given the full contract, let alone afforded the time to study it, interrogate union representatives based on real knowledge of its contents, and debate the way forward. The global auto industry is being reorganized at auto workers' expense, and with the support and complicity of the nationalist and pro-capitalist trade unions, Unifor in Canada, the UAW in the US, and the auto unions in Europe are all complicit in job cuts, production speed-up, plant shutdowns, and attacks on workers' rights. During the same week that Unifor announced its tentative agreement with Ford, Germany's Volkswagen, where the IG Metall union controls a majority on the automaker's supervisory board, revealed plans to slash up to 100,000 jobs across its global operations and close 4 sites in Germany. Corporations are deploying AI, automation, and restructuring as instruments of class war strategy, slashing labor costs and extracting ever greater profits from workers to sustain a crisis-ridden financial system, while governments divert social wealth to rearmament and war. This underscores that what auto workers face is not a normal collective bargaining struggle, but a social and political one. The proposed deal was endorsed unanimously by the union's Ford Master Bargaining Committee. If approved by workers in the shotgun ratification votes later this week, the tentative contract will cover 5,100 workers at the company's idled auto assembly operation in Oakville, Ontario, and its 2-engine plants in Windsor. It also covers workers at 3 small parts distribution centers. The fact that Unifor chose Ford as its target company, meaning the agreement sets the bar for further contracts for over 10,000 workers at Stellantis and GM, underscored that the bureaucracy is determined to work out another sweeping round of attacks with the auto bosses. Canada's entire auto industry is in a deep crisis, one sharply exacerbated by the trade war launched by Trump last year and escalated by corporate Canada's nationalist retaliatory tariffs. That being said, workers at Ford are arguably in the worst position across the Detroit 3's Canadian operations. The main plant at Oakville, which accounts for about 3,000 of the 5,100 workers employed by Ford Canada, has been on layoff for over 2 years, and the two engine plants in Windsor are heavily dependent on U.S. exports that could dry up should Trump intensify his America First trade war. Clearly, Unifor is counting on the vulnerable position and financial hardship facing the Ford Canada workers to overcome rank-and-file opposition to further givebacks. Workers must vote a resounding no at the ratification meetings and demand ample time to study the deal and discuss it amongst themselves. But if workers are to reverse the decades-long course of concessions and layoffs, a no vote can only be the beginning of the fight. Only through a rebellion against the union bureaucracy, in order to place power in the hands of workers on the shop floor, can auto workers wage a genuine struggle for their demands. This struggle necessitates the building of rank-and-file committees at every plant and the unification of Canadian workers with their class brothers and sisters in the U.S. and Mexico, in a joint struggle against the profit-hungry, internationally mobile auto giants. John DeAngelo, Ford Master Bargaining Chairman for the union, who also presides over the Windsor Engine Plant Autoworkers Local, already signaled the intent of the union's bargaining strategy last month, attempting to prepare the membership for yet another round of concession contracts. He ominously told the Windsor Star that workers mustn't expect too much if they're to secure corporate investment and product placements. Quote, "You can negotiate all the bells and whistles, but if you're not at work, you don't get any of it," he asserted. For DeAngelo and the rest of the Unifor bureaucracy, the so-called bells and whistles, to be sacrificed, mean basic workers' demands for an end to the two-tier system, recovery of ever-dwindling benefit packages, a restoration of defined pensions programs, a wage increase that exceeds the inflationary erosion of pay, and an end to the onerous shift scheduling, speed-up, and mandatory overtime provisions. DeAngelo's statement came shortly after the union announced that it planned to open early negotiations with Ford to set the industry pattern because Unifor has had a, quote, "long-standing and productive working relationship with the Ford Motor Company." That productive relationship has produced a long series of concession contracts. Indeed, soon after the last contract was settled in late 2023, also with the patterns set by Ford, some 3,200 workers at the company's giant assembly plant in Oakville, Ontario, were laid off. They have yet to return to work. During the 2023 contract ratification process, thousands of workers were told to expect only an 8-month shutdown for a now-scuttled electric vehicle retooling. That deal only passed by a narrow 54% vote, with a majority rejection in Oakville and an outright rejection by skilled trades across Ford's entire Canadian operation. Unifor is counting on the desperation of thousands of Oakville autoworkers, now laid off for almost 3 years, to reluctantly accept the new deal. They will dangle the latest undertaking from the company to begin production of a Super Duty pickup truck after Ford was promised a $465 million handout from the federal government that will, in about 5 more months, possibly restore jobs, but only for 1,800 workers. Over the past 4 decades, Unifor has trampled on all the militant traditions of earlier generations of auto workers and evolved into little more than a cheap labor contractor for the Detroit Three. Ever since the Canadian auto workers, the CAW, Unifor's predecessor, split from the UAW on a thoroughly nationalist basis in 1985, the unions on both sides of the Canada-US border have systematically pitted workers against each other, whipsawing jobs and conditions back and forth across the border in the name of defending Canadian and American jobs. As the globally mobile automakers have launched a sustained onslaught on the working class, transforming what was once one of the best-paying and secure industrial jobs into a precarious, multi-tiered, low-wage industry, Unifor and the UAW have offered their services as corporatist partners to the relevant executives and national governments, while whipping up poisonous Canada and American nationalism. Thus, the UAW is a champion of Trump's America First trade war, while Unifor cheers for a Team Canada based on the supposed common interest of workers and the corporate executives and capitalist oligarchs who profit from their exploitation. Payne's proposed contract with Ford Canada will not be the first time that Unifor, or its CAW predecessor, has concluded contract talks ahead of schedule under conditions where the auto companies, with union collusion, wield the club of unemployment to impose significant concessions. During the 2008 to 2009 financial crisis, the CAW, under President Buzz Hargrove, worked hand in glove with the big business federal and Ontario governments to restore the profitability of the automakers at workers' expense. They reopened the auto contracts with GM and Chrysler to impose draconian concessions, including multi-tier employment. Later, in fairness, the union ceded the same concessions to Ford, although it was not teetering on the brink of bankruptcy, to ensure it remained competitive. Echoing the corporatist partnership claims currently deployed by Unifor in their working relationship with the Ford auto bosses, Hargrove then bragged, "It's a win-win. I never thought like that before. I always thought of just winning for the membership." End quote. The critical lesson to be drawn from this entire experience is the urgent necessity to take the struggle for workers' rights and livelihoods out of the hands of the nationalist pro-company union bureaucracies. Already, the struggle to build rank-and-file committees among auto workers has taken root in auto plants in the United States, with committees rallying workers at NexTier and at other auto parts companies to defeat UAW sellout agreements. This movement is exemplified in the campaign of Will Lehman for the presidency of the United Auto Workers in the membership vote to be held later this year. A rank-and-file Mack Trucks worker from Pennsylvania, Lehman is working in the UAW on a socialist program to abolish the union bureaucracy and place power back into the hands of workers on the shop floor. Lehman opposes the nationalist protectionist policies of both the UAW and Unifor, which divide workers for the benefit of the auto bosses and corral them behind their own governments in trade war and the developing global war. Lehman is a leading representative of the International Workers' Alliance of Rank-and-File Committees, which exists to coordinate workers' struggles around the world, in opposition to the globally organized auto corporations. The IWARFC fights to unify auto workers in Canada with their fellow workers in the US, Mexico, and internationally, alongside all workers entering into struggle amid the skyrocketing cost of living due to the criminal U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. This organizational form expresses the reality of the class struggle today, which unfolds across national borders and cannot develop outside of a frontal assault on the dictatorial powers exercised over society by the financial oligarchy, opposition to imperialist war, and the fight for the reorganization of social and economic life to meet the needs of the vast majority, not provide greater profits for the few. You can find all this and more at the World Socialist website, wsws.org. This has been Archie Stone for the World Socialist website.
The World Socialist website is published by the International Committee of the Fourth International, the ICFI, the leadership of the World Socialist Movement, the Fourth International founded by Leon Trotsky in 1938. The World Socialist website relies entirely on the donations of readers and listeners for financial support. To give to the WSWS or to set up a regular monthly contribution, go to wsws.org/donate. We urge our listeners to join the International Committee of the Fourth International and one of its affiliated political parties and take up the struggle for socialism.